All right, Erev Tov to everyone. Welcome again to the Presence and the Jews, Part 4. Looking tonight at the presidencies of the 5th and 6th presidents, James Monroe and John Quincy Adams, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'il Nishmas Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib. The 5th president, James Monroe, presided over what historians, actually was a contemporary of his, called the Era of Good Feelings, 1817-1825. It's hard to imagine. There was such a time in American history, Era of Good Feelings. That's long in the past. At the time, the U.S. seems to have put all its wars behind it. There was room for expansion out west. And even the slavery conundrum was on the back burner for a few years. So Monroe was unique among the presidents in a number of ways. He was born April 28th, one of the great days of the year, 1758, to parents of modest means. His father died young, and James assumed responsibility for caring for his three younger siblings. So he never had much money then or throughout his life. And he always referred to his penurious state. He was the only president who actually fought in the Revolution. I mean, I guess Washington did in a sense, but I don't think Washington made it to combat. Monroe was a combat soldier who fought in the Battle of New York, right through our area, the Battle of Trenton, in which he was shot in the shoulder, and he carried the bullet inside him the rest of his life. He spent that brutal winter at Valley Forge together with Washington, and eventually rose to the rank of colonel. He was not a writer, nor was he that brilliant a thinker. So what was Monroe? Well, his contemporaries described him as tall and handsome. A female admirer said of Monroe, he had, quote, every perfection that a female can wish or a man can envy. That takes in a lot of territory. And more than that, he was good, decent, sensible, judicious, practical, energetic, ambitious, hypersensitive, slow but passionate. He trained in the law under Thomas Jefferson, but his political fortunes were really linked to Madison. Madison was slightly older than Monroe, but they became friends and partners, and Madison did suffer some slights along the way. Madison did not include Monroe in the Virginia delegation to the Constitutional Convention. He didn't really trust him as much as they were friends. It was just as well, because Monroe had many doubts about the Constitution. To him, the federal government was just too powerful. The Senate and the judiciary were too powerful. And the territory encompassed by the 13 colonies was just too large to be managed by one central government. So Monroe at the time was in the Virginia State Legislature, and he voted against the Constitution. So he, in fact, becomes the only president, only person to become president, who voted against the passage of the Constitution. And so it was in 1789 that Monroe was used by Patrick Henry, who was an anti-federalist, to halt Madison's ascension first to the Senate, and then he tried to the House as well. Henry carved out a district for Madison that was filled with anti-federalists, and he ran Monroe against Madison. That campaign was the only one in history that ever pit two future presidents against each other. Madison won 1,308 votes to 972. If you think about it, there's not a lot of people voting. It's like the Teaneck local elections. So they reconciled soon after, and Monroe became a U.S. Senator from Virginia, again through the machinations of Patrick Henry. In 1794, George Washington appointed Monroe the Minister to France, and there he had reconciled with Madison, and he and his wife bought much of the furniture and personal items for the newly married James and Dolly Madison. In the ongoing dispute in the 1790s and the first decade of the 19th century between supporters of Britain and supporters of France, so Monroe was like Jefferson and to some extent Madison, a Francophile, and he feared that Alexander Hamilton, had too much influence on Washington. He was out of the country for a long time, Monroe. He only came back when John Adams was the president. So he was out of politics for a long time. In 1799, this time at Madison's direction, Monroe became governor of Virginia. It sounds strange because this one made him a senator, this one made him a governor. It was like that then. If you had one powerful patron, since most people, human beings, did not vote, voting was limited to male landowners, so you had a powerful patron, that usually was sufficient. Monroe was the governor of Virginia, and it wasn't an entirely joyous experience. He had to deal with a mass rebellion of slaves, and in the end, 27 were hanged and many others deported to the West Indies. Later, as president, Monroe supported the American Colonization Society, which favored the repatriation of black slaves to Africa. Now, it sounds racist, like everything else today, but about 15,000 blacks were sent back to Liberia, where they lived in freedom. Liberia was so grateful. What's the capital of Liberia? Monrovia. It's the only city in Africa that's named for an American president. In the celebration, in gratitude for Monroe's act in sending the black slaves back to Africa. Monroe's political fortunes were then linked to Madison and were a source of both aggravation and redemption. Although Madison was Jefferson's Secretary of State, he had won only one election in his life, that one against Monroe in 1789, and he suffered in comparison to Jefferson's popularity. The Federalists already hated Jefferson and Madison, and even some of the Democratic Republicans looked to Monroe as a challenger to Madison in the election of 1808. So he was co-opted to run again. It was the second time he would challenge Madison, this time for president. And Monroe lost in a landslide, garnering only 3 electoral votes, coming in third place. And then, too, Madison wrote him off, refused to talk to him. Monroe held out the hope that Madison would be magnanimous in victory, but neither James nor Dolly would hear of it. Relations were frozen, and the two did not talk for several years. Over time, Jefferson worked to thaw relations. Monroe became the governor of Virginia again in 1811, but he lasted just a few months. In April 1811, Madison, now reconciled, appointed Monroe the Secretary of State. And Monroe entered at an opportune moment. The United States had banned trade with Britain and France as one of Jefferson's last acts in office. But Madison, soon after taking office, opened trade with Britain. But soon after that, the British reneged, and they again began seizing American ships on the high seas. So Madison's appointment of Monroe was designed to shore up Madison's support in his own party and enable him to take a more aggressive position against Britain. So soon, in 1812, the two countries were at war. As there was no one event that precipitated the war, the Federalists opposed it in Congress. And the war did not go well, especially because the country was still divided into various militias, did not have a national army. People made their reputations off the war. Out west, William Henry Harrison became president number 9, led his militia. In the south, Andrew Jackson, number 7, fought. And in the north, Madison had a very hard time sustaining combat forces. The Massachusetts militia refused to fight. All the federal strongholds refused to get involved. The New York militia would defend New York State, but they refused to cross the Niagara border and fight in Canada. And as we know, the British captured much of the Middle Atlantic, including the nation's capital, and the Midwest as well. Detroit was surrendered at one point. In retrospect, it was probably a mistake to get it back. Now, Monroe himself asked to lead troops into combat as Secretary of State. It was a different time back then. But he was outranked. He had left the Continental Army as a colonel, so he'd have to be responsive to the generals in whom he had no trust. He did not want to be anyone's subordinate. But as the state secretary, he still plotted an invasion of Canada, but no one really listened to him. It was not a glorious war. 1 out of every 8 American soldiers deserted. Americans were usually outnumbered on the battlefield, even though the American population greatly exceeded that of Canada. Battlefield orders were often confusing and contradictory. Britain was also preoccupied with its fighting in Europe. The Americans were even fighting half-heartedly in 1814 when the Tsar, at the same time Tsar Alexander I, was trying to mediate peace talks. The peace talks failed because the British asked for the dissolution of the United States, and that was not negotiable. I mentioned last week, August 1814, the British captured Washington, D.C., burnt the White House, the Capitol, the Departments of State, the War, and the Treasury. And finally, discontented with the conduct of the war, Madison made Monroe the Secretary of War also, the only time someone held both positions simultaneously. Keep in mind, now the Secretaries of War, Navy, Army are combined into one Secretary of Defense. So imagine a Secretary of State and Defense, the same person. That was Monroe. Around that time, when there was a change in the cabinet, Madison appealed for public support. It was a tough sell. In 1814, New England wanted to secede. Madison's party took a thrashing in the 1814 midterm elections. The government was running out of money. Madison was a physical and emotional wreck. And in December of 1814, his vice president, Elbridge Gerry, he of the gerrymandering fame, carving out congressional districts to suit one's party, died. As you remember, Madison, the only president whose two vice presidents both died under him. But the tide turned suddenly and unexpectedly. In late 1814, New England decided not to secede. The European wars ended, and the British decided to settle for the status quo ante in the Americas in the Treaty of Ghent. And the war ended on a high note, with Andrew Jackson's conquest of New Orleans with very few American casualties. And it was the United States' greatest victory of the war, and one that had come after the treaty was signed ending the war, but before word came back to America. So Jackson emerged a hero, as did Madison and Monroe, especially because the unexpected outcome of the war was the great expansion of U.S. territory in the South and Midwest, and the devastation to the American Indian. So in fact, Madison left office in 1817 on a high. The budget was again in surplus. The people were happy. Madison was even happier to be out of office. And he, in effect, bequeathed the office to James Monroe. Now, James Monroe's one encounter, famous encounter with Jews, was a troublesome one that almost affected his election in 1816. And one that we discussed briefly last week. I want to go into a little more detail this week. Mordechai Manuel Noah, that Jewish native of Philadelphia and Charleston, was dispatched as U.S. consul to the Barbary States in Tunis in 1813, the first American Jewish diplomat. He won the appointment through the intervention of powerful friends who appealed to Madison and Monroe. Noah was a charismatic-looking figure, a hefty individual with large red whiskers, and he eventually won freedom for the American hostages in the Barbary States by arranging payments to the ruling pashas. In 1815, he suddenly received a letter from Monroe, the Secretary of State, that read as follows. I quote, "At the time of your appointment as consul at Tunis, it was not known that the religion that which you profess would form any obstacle to the exercise of your consular functions. Recent information, however, on which entire reliance may be placed, proves that it would produce a very unfavorable effect, in consequence of which the president has deemed it necessary to revoke your commission." End quote. Now, Noah was flabbergasted, to say the least. Keep in mind, he was dismissed. He wasn't just reassigned to another posting. He had come to Tunis from Riga. And the wealthy Jews in his hometown of Charleston, still the largest city of a large Jewish population of any American city at that time, they were enraged. Madison sent an army officer, a Jew, to Charleston to speak publicly and assuage their feelings. But the administration's pretext soon unraveled. In fact, Noah himself had written to Monroe in 1811 as Secretary of State when he was seeking the position, saying that his religion would be a benefit, that it will show the world that the American government does not discriminate against its citizens based on their religion. So once that was revealed, that part of Madison's argument and Monroe's argument crumbled, and Madison even sent a letter to Noah admitting that his Jewishness was well known at the time of his commission. Years later, a letter written by Madison surfaced in which he admitted that recalling Noah should be blamed, quote, on the ascertained prejudices of the Turks against his religion, end quote. I mean, it was a complete fabrication. Then they tried to pin on Noah some financial irregularities, playing to an obvious prejudice against Jews, but that didn't work either. And eventually the government had to reimburse Noah for some of his expenses. The real reason seemed to relate to Noah's to rumors about Noah that was spread by his predecessor, Tobias Lear, who was a popular figure in Washington and saw himself as the leading expert on affairs Barbary States. Lear had begun the practice of paying bribes to the Barbary pirates, and that was pinned on Noah, who became a target because he was badmouthed by a Swedish diplomat who liked Lear and didn't like Jews. And Lear spread this news in Washington in the social circles, and eventually reached Madison and Monroe. In fact, Lear was annoyed. He never met Noah, but he was annoyed that he was not consulted on Noah's on his replacement, and he gleefully shared with his friends bad reports about Noah emanating from hostile elements in Tunis. And of course, nothing could be attributed to Noah's conduct in Tunis because the government was disavowing any knowledge of the bribes that were being paid. So that practice, in fact, stopped with the defeat of the pirates in the Second Barbary War in 1815, shortly after Noah's departure. Now, Noah himself attributed his departure to the bribery scheme for which he had government approval, and they just felt he would be a convenient scapegoat for it. Truth be told, Madison and Monroe, as Secretary of State, appointed two other Jewish diplomats during their tenure, one of whom was a Shomer Shabbos even during his posting, meaning the consulate was closed, did not do any business on Shabbos. But Noah, always resentful, became a newspaper editor. And trust me, the worst thing you want is a resentful newspaper editor. He never let slurs against Jews pass without a biting remark. Became very active in New York in politics, Tammany Hall, community leader, even briefly served as the sheriff in New York City. When he was appointed, the Christians complained that it would be unseemly to give a Jew the authority to hang a Christian, which is one of the tasks of the sheriff. And Noah responded, "What kind of good Christian would have to be hanged? So he'd be doing a service for everybody." Among the things that he did, Noah, as sheriff, is that he foolishly freed all the debtors from debtors' prison, becoming personally responsible for their debts, which after they were gone, he realized that he could not pay. Noah wrote a book in 1819 about his experiences entitled Travels in England, France, Spain, and the Barbary States in the years 1813, 1814, which he told his tale. And he was a philanthropist also. He was one of the founders of Mount Sinai Hospital and New York University as well. But Mordechai Emanuel Noah is best known for two quixotic schemes that were an outgrowth of his disillusionment with his treatment as a diplomat. One in retrospect that was prescient, and the other that was quite romantic and impractical. So, the first, on April 27th, 1818, some dated a month later, by the way, at Sherith Israel in New York City, he spoke from the pulpit about Jewish history, and he called for, in essence, what we call today a Zionist reawakening. And he said from the pulpit, 1,800 years have passed without shedding a ray of happiness upon the Jews. So he wanted in America to increase Jewish educational opportunities. The first Jewish school opened up, by the way, about 15 years earlier in New York, especially in Hebrew, to prevent assimilation. And he was secular, he was not religious. And to retrain Jews in agriculture. And then he said, there are more than 7 million Jews in the world today, I quote, a number greater than at any period in our history, and possessing more wealth, activity, influence, and talents than anybody of people of their number on earth. Now, I'm not sure any part of that sentence is true. Not the number of Jews, I think there were more at the time, nor the influence of the Jews, but nonetheless, this was his point. He urged Jews to mobilize. He said, we can easily summon 100,000 men into the field and march on Syria. By Syria, he meant, of course, the land of Israel, southern Syria. And, quote, look toward that country where our people have established a mild, just, and honorable government, accredited by the world and admired by all good men. And he finished by telling his audience, never were prospects for the restoration of the Jewish nation to their ancient rights and dominion more brilliant than they are at present. This was in 1818. It was this speech, copies of which were sent to John Adams and James Madison, among others, that led Adams to write in response, I wish your nation may be admitted to all the privileges of citizens in every country in the world, and that he can envision as well a reborn Jewish state in Judea. Madison responded to Noah, but in blander terms. Well, you shouldn't be surprised, nothing came of it. And Noah repeated his call for Shivat Zion again in 1844 at the height of his influence in a speech and then a pamphlet he published called Discourse on the Restoration of the Jews. And he tried to enlist Christian support for this venture. And again, he wasn't religious, and he soon realized that even if the opportunity presented itself, the greatest difficulty would be not convincing the world to allow it, but convincing the Jews to go. And he reasoned in his writings, of those who were persecuted, most would go. Of those who were free, few would go. And he saw as well, even in his time, how even talk of Aliyah made American Jews uncomfortable. This was 1844, and not much has changed in 180 years. He also publicized the theory that American Indians were descendants of the 10 lost tribes. And there are reports, you know, they linger till today. Certain tribes of the time maintained strange customs. There was one Indian tribe in the Southwest that for 7 days in the fall would walk around with a palm branch in their hands, like a lulav. So who knows? But in 1820, Noah cooked up another scheme. The aforementioned Tsar Alexander I had been a benign Tsar. He was the one who gave all Russian Jews last names in 1815. But by 1820, he had instituted Jew-hating edicts about residence, limiting where Jews could live, profession, what we could do, and a dark century for Jews in the Pale of Settlement loomed. In 1820, Mordechai Manuel Noah asked the New York legislature to grant him land in order to start a Jewish colony, a Jewish homeland. The legislature declined. Surprise, surprise. So in 1825, Noah and some Christian allies bought tracts of land in a place called Grand Island on the Niagara River outside Buffalo, not far from Niagara Falls. It straddles the border between Buffalo and Canada. Bought it for $4.38 an acre, on which he proposed to establish a homeland for the Jewish people across the world who were persecuted. Now, it seems bizarre, then and now. We visited there a little over a year ago. There's a bridge crossing over. There's a sign, Grand Island. There's even a plaque commemorating the event. But it doesn't seem to have that much room on that little island to hold a sizable number of anything. Noah, now already convinced of his greatness, called it Ararat, a city of refuge for the Jews. Why Ararat? Well, that's after the mountain on which Noah's ark rested after the flood. And he was Noah. So therefore, this is his Ararat. And he dedicated it in September 1825. The ceremony was held in a church in Buffalo that he rented for the purpose. He hoped to attract French and Jewish, French and German Jewish merchants and Russian Jews who would want the farmland. One honored guest at the dedication ceremony was Chief Red Jacket of the Seneca Indians, whom Noah held to be the head of one of the 10 tribes that had come to America, the Seneca Indians. Noah himself wore a royal costume with a gold medallion neck chain, declared this island the Jewish refuge under the protection of the laws and constitution of the United States, and declared himself humbly the judge of Israel. And he asked that Jews across the world be taxed 3 silver shekels to the project. How do you think it went over? Yeah. Nothing came of it. Surprise. Not the least of which because he was ridiculed by other Jews in the U.S., and certainly across the world. Noah himself lost interest in the project within a few months. He returned to New York, and it was then that he began his plans for the restoration of Jews to the land of Israel. Nothing came of that either, at least for another 50 years when the official Zionist movement got underway. Mordechai Emanuel Noah was easily the most prominent Jew in America during his time. He died of a stroke in New York City in 1851, just shy of 66 years of age. So Monroe, that happened actually during Adams' presidency, but Noah's saga straddled both presidencies. Monroe, in 1817, defeated Rufus King in a landslide, 183-34, and of course that was the era of good feelings. With the landslide, the Federalist Party essentially collapsed, and for one of the rare times in American history, it was basically only one party operating. Monroe was wise. He appointed some Federalists to political office, and even twice traveled the country. First time any American president did that, speaking and meeting citizens. In fact, he launched both trips in New England, the Federalist stronghold, to show that he wanted to be the president of all the people. Yes, that did exist at one time in American history. There was a sense of national unity. Wars and economic hardships were in the past. Monroe made a concerted effort not to appear partisan, nor to do anything that was perceived as partisan. At the same time, he was also clever enough not to alienate his own supporters. So even the panic of 1819, a financial crisis, and the slavery arguments that led to the Missouri Compromise in 1820, trying to balance new states by admitting defined slave states and free states, all that did little to impinge on Monroe's re-election in 1820, which he won with 80% of the popular vote, running essentially unopposed. I think he just lost one electoral vote. Those were the days. His daughter, he had a number of children. His daughter Maria married in 1820. It was the first wedding in the White House of a president's child. And his second term is remembered most for the Monroe Doctrine. What a doctrine that was. A great doctrine. Monroe's doctrine was approved by Congress, declared that, I quote, "The American continents, by the free and independent condition which they have assumed and maintain, are henceforth not to be considered a subject for future colonization by any European powers," and asserting that any attempt by European power to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and safety. So in fact, it was a declaration by very self-confident United States of America to Europe, hands off this entire hemisphere. This is now where we are the hegemons. Ironically, the Monroe Doctrine was urged by Britain, who wanted to keep the rest of Europe away from the New World so as to maintain its trade relations unimpeded. The doctrine, though, might have played a role in Jewish history, we'll get back to that, but it was unprecedented expression of American diplomatic and political strength, even though for decades it was enforced by the British Navy, because the U.S. did not have a navy, but it has served American interests for almost 2 centuries. Naturally, John Kerry declared the Monroe Doctrine dead just 2 years ago. Okay. Now, the Monroe Doctrine was called after Monroe. Yes, 2013 he did. It was called after Monroe, but it was actually conceived and largely drafted by our second subject tonight, John Quincy Adams, who served for all of 8 years as James Monroe's Secretary of State. Now, note this well. That was the early pattern. four of the first six presidents had previously served as secretaries of state. In the ensuing 30, among the next 38 presidents until today, only one person who had served as Secretary of State has been elected president, and that was the hapless James Buchanan. Memo to Hillary Clinton, don't start measuring the drapes for the White House. Adams was born in 1767, named for his great-grandfather, John Quincy, after the town of Quincy was named where he was born. His great-grandfather died just 2 days after Adams was born. From age 11, young man, John Quincy accompanied his father, John, on all his diplomatic assignments, and he kept an extensive diary that ran to 50 volumes at his death. And he had his own very distinguished diplomatic career. Washington made John Quincy Adams the minister to the Netherlands and to Portugal. Madison appointed a minister to Russia in 1811, and then the minister to Britain after the War of 1812 ended. Madison was extremely bright, but admittedly not very warm, nor very personable, and a bit of a weird duck also. He was a slovenly dresser, and in the White House he kept his pet alligator in the bathtub. I don't know where you keep your pet alligators, but he kept it in the White House bathtub. He was known, though, as a skilled diplomat, spoke six languages without a teleprompter, and was a natural as Secretary of State. Unlike his father, he did not reject classic Christian theology, although he, too, technically was a Unitarian. Now, surly people usually have trouble in politics, and the election of 1824 was one of the most contested in American history. It featured four candidates, all vying for the presidency, all talented people. So it's quite astonishing, if you think about it, the only two presidents who were the sons of presidents, John Quincy Adams and George W. Bush, were both elected in two of the three most contested, divisive elections in American history. And both Adams and Bush in his first election, 2000, lost the popular vote. So John Quincy Adams ran against General Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, war hero, popular victor of that Battle of New Orleans that electrified the nation. He ran against Henry Clay, the popular Speaker of the House of Representatives from Kentucky, and William Crawford, who was in the cabinet with him as Secretary of the Treasury. Jackson won a large plurality of the votes. It wasn't even close. It wasn't like Bush Gore. Jackson won 41% of the vote to Quincy Adams' 31% of the vote. Jackson won 99 electoral votes to John Quincy Adams' 84. But because Crawford won 41 and Clay won 37, Jackson did not win a majority of the Electoral College. So from that perspective, Bush-Gore was actually easier to decide. Even though Gore won more popular votes, you know, Bush won more states, 30 states to 20 states, neither of that matters. What matters is the Electoral College winning a majority. And once Bush was awarded Florida's votes by the Supreme Court, so he won a majority of electoral votes, squeaking to victory. But here, no one gained a majority. And pursuant to the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, when this happens, the president is elected by the House of Representatives, in which each state gets one vote. I mean, state delegations get together, they take a vote as to who they want to be their to whom they want to award their state's vote, and that's how it's done. Jackson had won 12 states of the 24 in the popular election, but in the House, the vote went differently. Now, Clay came in fourth place, so by the Constitution, he was eliminated from the competition. Only the top three vote-getters compete, and Clay threw his support behind Adams, saying of Jackson, whom he hated, "I cannot believe that killing 2,500 Englishmen at New Orleans qualifies for the various difficult and complicated duties of the chief magistrate." Adams won in the House, 13 states to Jackson's 7. Crawford got 4. So think about it, 24 states, you need a minimum of 13 to win the election. Adams got those 13, won by one vote. And when Adams appointed Clay his Secretary of State, Jackson and his supporters screamed about the corrupt bargain in which they allege Clay sold his office and his votes in order to join the cabinet. Now, truth be told, there are persistent rumors that whether or not Jackson knew about it, one of his supporters, a congressman who later became president, that same hapless James Buchanan, made Clay the same offer on behalf of Jackson. But that's never been substantiated. The rumors are out there. But nonetheless, that infuriated Jackson, riled up all his supporters, and that phrase, corrupt bargain, would enter the American political lexicon, and it would be used by Jackson as a campaign slogan when he defeated Adams in 1828 for re-election, when Adams, like his father, lost the election for a second term. Of the four people who've lost re-election to a second term in American history, two had the last name Adams. And like his father, John Quincy refused to attend the inauguration of his successor. That's how bitter he was. So Adams served one term, quite unremarkable term. Allegedly, he took his oath of office not on a Bible, but a book of constitutional law. While president for his 4 years, he focused on domestic projects, including road building, which was important. Little was accomplished in foreign affairs, but Adams had been so successful as Secretary of State that American foreign relations were on very sound footing. Now, John Quincy did not have an extensive relationship with Jews, as far as it's known. He, like his father, an appreciation of Jewish history, and he, like his father, wrote to Mordechai Manuel Noah that I believe in the rebuilding of Judea as an independent nation. But his interactions with Jews were less salubrious. Even as his father hinted the same, it was a source of great puzzlement to many elitist Americans that Jews retained their faith and did not just embrace Christianity. So John Quincy had a cousin, distant cousin, named Hannah Adams, who was poor, became a writer and a historian, and remained poor, but she did it to earn money. She wrote a book on comparative religions, and in 1812, she wrote a book called The History of the Jews. It was a very sympathetic study, but in the book she wrote that she could not understand why Jews continued to reject Jesus. She founded, in 1816, an organization called the Female Society of Boston and Vicinity for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews. At least there's truth in advertising. Within a short time, the movement spread. There were 20 chapters in New York alone, and John Quincy Adams was an early donor to his cousin's cause. So there was an openness towards Jews. But at the end of the day, there always remained this enigma. Because Christianity was the world's dominant religion, how is it possible that Jews retain an allegiance to God and Torah? Adams was the only president who, after he left office, was re-elected to Congress, to the House. There he served for 18 years. While in Congress, he became an outspokenly fierce opponent of slavery and famously argued in the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of the slaves who rebelled on the ship Amistad, so Steven Spielberg would have it, and he won their freedom. The court ruled that the slaves could be free. While in Congress, though, he was quoted in a slightly nasty fashion, referring to a fellow congressman, David Yuli Levy, as the alien Jew from Florida. Now, Levy was born in St. Thomas, like most American Jews then, Sephardic offspring. His father, Moses Levy, was a businessman and a Mordechai Noah imitator. His father bought 50,000 acres of land near Jacksonville, called it New Jerusalem, and urged Jews from across the world to come and settle. Truth be told, we had to choose between Jacksonville and Buffalo. Probably choose Jacksonville. But that too did not work out. Eventually, his son David became a delegate to the House of Representatives from Florida before it became a state, and then he became the first Jewish senator ever, David Yuli Levy. It was in the House where John Quincy made his crack about Levy, circumstances unknown, but in fact, Levy had intermarried. He married the daughter of a former governor of Kentucky, and he converted to Christianity, became a big advocate of slavery and secession. So maybe he literally was the alien Jew from Florida. I don't think it was as much animus as much as it was unfamiliarity. Notwithstanding all this, Jews continued to feel comfortable in the United States during Adams' term, and it was the start of the massive immigration of Jews to the United States, especially from Germany, that within 6 decades, 1820 to 1880, swelled the Jewish population of the United States. So in 1820, there still were only about 3,000 Jews living in America. By 1880, 60 years later, there were 300,000 Jews living in America. By 1920, another 40 years later, there are almost 3 million Jews in America. In the early years, Jews came mostly from Central Europe and overwhelmingly from Germany. They moved across the country, St. Louis and Minneapolis, to Cleveland, Cincinnati, and later out west, even to San Francisco. So what happened? And here's a theory that I have. Obviously, the situation in Europe was never good, and it fluctuated from bad to worse. So here's the theory. What changed in the mind of European Jews is to the credit of Monroe and John Quincy Adams, and that was the Monroe Doctrine. Think about it. Europe was toxic for Jews. It was for 800 years already, and would certainly be for the next century, become even more toxic. To go to a country that announced to Europe, in essence, hands off the Americas, was an unimaginable and unprecedented refuge, a land where there is not only religious freedom and the quality of citizenship, but a land also where the European countries are barred from the whole neighborhood. So that was very appealing to Jews. That is a country that is worth moving to, even at the tremendous cost and with all the risk that entails. So you think of doctrine, you know, Monroe Doctrine, what it mean at the time. It was a proud statement of America, but who knows, it could have had a very strong impact on Jewish history as well. Amazing how one doctrine transformed America's perception of the world and the world's perception of America, and in fact the Jewish people's perception of America as well. That is a lasting tribute, even though it was unintentional, to James Monroe and to John Quincy Adams. All right, next week we're off, but in 2 weeks we'll look at the presidencies of Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren, and we'll look at the very interesting case, the very first time an American president intervened diplomatically on behalf of a beleaguered Jewish community outside the United States. All that 2 weeks from now. I thank you all very much.